stars live here.
Are you ready?
On air. Online.
Are you ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream. Broadcasting from Montreal and around the world.
The Jeremy White Show, available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Welcome to the Jeremy White Show. Great to have you along with us. I'm excited to bring you an interview that kind of got lost in the digital dust on my laptop. It was supposed to come out back in February 2024. I have so many things on my hard drive. It's so hard to keep track. I got to fire my producer. I'm just kidding. No, he's fantastic. Big shout out to Joe Cristiano. Sam Roberts was going to be hitting the road, and the whole point of this interview was to promote a bunch of tour dates in Buffalo and a whole bunch of different cities in the U.S., and latest record is phenomenal. Came out last fall, too. So I'm going to bring you that interview right now with Montreal's own Sam Roberts. Let's get over to it. And just so you know, pretty much every tour date that I mention has passed at this point. So go to his website, go to his socials, look up if he's going to be coming to your neighborhood anytime soon. Let's get right over to Sam Roberts. Our next guest is an actual legend from Montreal. Latest record came back in the fall, The Adventures of Ben Black, and a bunch of tour dates across the country. We're going to be performing this upcoming weekend in Buffalo. I'm going to be heading off to the West Coast as well. Visit Sam Roberts Band on Instagram and all the socials to get their tour dates and check out the new music. And of course, last year was the 20th anniversary of We Were Born in a Flame. We'll talk all about that. Welcome back to the show for the... this is the first time you're on the show. I don't think we've ever chatted, Sam.
Somehow it feels like we have.
I know, it's weird. Like, I hear you on the radio like every day in Montreal, so it's like I feel familiar. Anyways, welcome to the show, Sam Roberts. Thank you. Everybody,
thank you.
I think maybe we ran into each other backstage at some point or something. There's no way we've never met.
Yeah, at this point it would literally be impossible, I think.
Yeah, I was on the Beat 92.5 in Montreal for like 10 years, so it's like I'm sure we ran into
in Montreal, you know, it's, as you know, it's 2 degrees of separation at best, if you're lucky.
It's ridiculous how big of a small city it is.
Oh, yeah. Life just follows you around everywhere you go here. It's amazing.
Even at this point in your career, I mean, like, do you still feel like the music scene is like that in a way in Montreal? Like, is it a small community?
I mean, it is. I have to say that I checked out a little bit, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, of course.
In terms of actually going out and hanging out at all the bars that we used to hang out, like the Biff Tech and
Biff Tech's still there, but it's not the same.
It's still there, you know. We've handed off the baton probably to several generations since it was kind of our time.
Yeah.
The friends that I made in those days are still very much people that I'm close to today. So, I'm happy to know. I try to keep my ear to the ground a little bit to either hear about new bands that are coming up, and for sure, once in a while, a band comes out of Montreal that, you know, becomes my favorite band for a while, and I'm glad to know that that part of the music scene is still very much alive and well. But
it is your city, right? So it's like you're gonna take a little bit of pride when somebody from Montreal is actually good.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not surprising either, though. I mean, it's still a place that really embraces the idea of music being, a valuable part of life and culture. And I can't say that that's the same attitude towards music or musicians and the choice of making music a way of life in many other places. But definitely in Montreal, it's a place where and I think that's why people, even people who aren't born and raised here in Montreal, gravitate towards the city, because it is it's a celebrated line of work in a way. Whether you get paid for it or not, the choice to embark on that kind of journey can be a really difficult one, especially when you're young and trying to find your way in the world. So I think this is a place where you feel secure in that decision.
Right. Take me back to when you first discovered your love for music. I mean, do you remember the moment when you decided that you're going to be a musician?
Man, it was, it's been a part of my life since I can remember. I think there were several sort of phases to it, though, when I was young. First of all, as a classical musician, I played the violin. I took it quite seriously. I practiced a lot. I thought of myself being on stage playing violin. For the longest time, I thought of myself as hopefully becoming a violinist at some point.
Me too, man. I watched Shania Twain up live in Chicago when I was growing up, and I wanted to play the fiddle because of that, but also because John Williams in the Star Wars soundtrack. I was obsessed with the violin and the fiddle. Like, I don't know.
We used to get 7 inches, and I'd get the Star, you know, you could get the Star Wars soundtrack, you know, the beautiful, amazing music by John Williams on 7-inch, and listen to an abridged version of the whole Star Wars saga or whatever. And for sure, I used to try to play along to that. My parents are from South Africa, and they had to learn O Canada to go through their citizenship.
I was going to say, to become citizens, they had to sing the anthem.
Yeah, and they had to sing the anthem, but in order to learn it, they literally got a 7-inch vinyl record of the anthem. So I would put that on, and I remember I'd been playing for a few years at that point, because they only became citizens I was about 6 or 7 years old when that happened. So I'd sit there with the violin trying to learn O Canada on the violin. But seeing Itzhak Proman, he played in Montreal back in the day, and he was one of my violin heroes. So those were the kinds of moments where you'd sort of see somebody on stage, and you had that sort of flash of, you know, just that little vision of maybe yourself being that person one day.
Right.
And then I started playing in a band in high school, and that quickly overran, or, you know, chased my classical ambitions out the door, you know.
And it's kind of funny because you're talking about, you know, the Canadian citizenship exam and all that stuff. Ironically, my producer Joe just got his Canadian citizenship today.
Oh, is that right? Well, congratulations, Joe.
Yeah.
Welcome to the family.
He got in. They let him in. I don't know why, but they let him in. So you go from being a classical musician. I mean, like, when did you discover? I mean, like, you're a rock fan, you're a pop fan, you're a music fan in general. But like, the Sam Roberts Band has a distinctive sound, I would say.
Yeah, you know, I think at age 12 is when I started to sort of think of, like, you know, learning how to play guitar and using the fact that music was already a big part of my life to sort of springboard into another thing. And you have to meet like-minded people. So much of how you move through your life comes to do with, you know, has to do with the friends that you make along the way. And I met a few people in grade 7 who were listening to Jesus and Mary Chain and REM and bands like that. And all of a sudden I find myself going out and buying their cassettes or dubbing their cassettes or whatever the early form of piracy was at the time.
Before ShareBear and LimeWire.
Exactly. and starting to dress like them and cut my hair like them. And then I wanted to play guitar, and I'd be learning how to play Beatles songs and Jesus and Mary's Chain songs in the same breath almost on my dad's giant necked classical Spanish guitar or whatever that he didn't really play much, but it was sat in the corner. And yeah, all of a sudden you start finding yourself gravitating towards this whole new thing. But it was very much driven at the beginning, obviously by a love of music, but also by the people that you surrounded yourself with.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you say that, because I mean, a lot of the musicians I talk to, they really do talk about the hang being the most influential and being the most creative spark. It's like, if you surround yourself with smart, talented people, you're probably going to come up with something good.
Well, we weren't smart or talented, so I don't know what, but there were enough of us that it just kind of lit the fire. And to be honest, we weren't one of those bands that, you know, by age 14, 15, we're starting to show signs of promise, either in the way that we played our instruments or in the way we played shows or performed on stage or how we wrote songs. That took us a long time to sort of find the footing, you know, find where the good songs were lying, excuse me, inside us. And I think it was the fact that we were so persistent, that we didn't take no for an answer, despite the fact that it wasn't sort of, nothing was pointing towards success for a very long time, has been part of the DNA and the spirit of our band, and probably why I'm still doing it to this day. There was something about all of it that just wouldn't let go and made you want to dig deeper and find it, because you kind of have this sense that it's there, it's in you. But it's up to you, and part of the work is to how to unearth that thing, how to unearth the music, how to find your voice and all of it.
Coming from a classical background, was it difficult to transition into writing more standard sort of pop songs? I mean, do you approach it from a scientific standpoint, or is it beneath you? Like, how do you get out of that classical time, out of that classical mindset?
I mean, I just sort of went straight to the Beatles world. You know, the Beatles were my favorite band growing up, and you know, when it wasn't about classical music, and even the Beatles they incorporated a lot of, you know, I guess
orchestral parts and their stuff.
Orchestral work in what they were doing, which is something that I always related to. And I thought, oh, this is an interesting sort of application of what I'm already learning, but put into a pop structure sensibility. But in terms of, you know, like, what is this? What is song structure? What is it? You know, what is this whole new format? Like verse, chorus, bridge, chorus kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out how to use those sort of parameters and not be limited by them. And to this day, that's part of what I'm drawn to in terms of songwriting. How can you take that sort of format and stretch it and pull it and find new ways to take people somewhere through a song? And you have 3.5 minutes to do it, but you want them to feel like they sort of lifted off the ground and gone somewhere and come back in this impossibly short period of time. But that to me is the art, and it's really difficult to do at the beginning, and it's still difficult to do today. But I think that was the initial sort of struggle, was to figure out what the possibilities were inside this whole idea of writing a rock and roll song.
Right, and it's also trying to connect with people, and you don't necessarily know like, what are people going to connect with? I mean, you could write the dumbest song ever, you're like, oh, this is shit, but then it's like it becomes a hit, you're like, how does everybody like this?
Yeah, I mean, it's always the dumbest songs that you write that are, you know, people latch on to.
Yeah,
like, the for sure. And you have to be careful, because when you're consciously writing a song, you're like, man, this is pretty lowest common denominator stuff, you can guarantee that that's the one that gets picked up to get played on the radio. So yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of what the potential pitfalls are when you're writing songs. And I think as a rule of thumb, then it becomes about just make sure that no matter what you're doing, that you feel something about it, that you feel connected to it in some way. Don't do something just to toss it out there into the universe, you know, something that you knowingly have no sort of attachment to on any kind of emotional level. So that's kind of become, I guess, this how I take the temperature, you know, what I think about a song, what my relationship is with the songs that I write anyway. So do I feel something for what I'm doing? And it can be anything. It doesn't have to be what the song is about lyrically. It can just be the way the notes fit together. It could be something rhythmically in it that I find compelling in some way, but I've got to feel something. And if I don't feel anything for it, then I would never let anybody else hear it.
Yeah. No, that's it. I mean, I'm sure you got like hundreds of demos sitting on a hard drive somewhere, and you're like, this, you know, it was a good idea at the time, but yeah, now it's not so.
Yeah. It's funny. You know, you accumulate all this stuff. You got this whole cat. You're like, man, there must be some hidden gems in there. I'm going to go back and see if I, you know, I mean, yeah. And you're like, nope. No, that wasn't very good either. No.
Yeah, but then you never know. It's like you take one little guitar, like as dumb as you might think it is, and then you give it to a collaborator, and then like, oh, that's a great idea. But you're like, wait, what? No, that's terrible. And then they take it to a whole different, completely different atmosphere that you were expecting it to go. And I mean, is collaboration a big part of your process?
No, zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By yourself.
That's why my bad riffs stay bad riffs. I should probably, you know, check the old ego at the door and start seeing if other people can bring new dimensions to it. No, I mean, songwriting's just always been a very kind of solitary pursuit for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something I think it's what I look for. So much of everything else that we do is in public, you know, whether it's performing or any of that, talking to you, you know, there's this very sort of public face to everything. But songwriting is this time where you can sort of pull back into your own thoughts and really Explore what moves you. And like I was saying before, I really do write songs sort of based on sort of an emotional connection to what I'm doing, in that if I feel something, I'll keep going. I'll keep pursuing that idea. As the second I stop feeling anything for it, I backtrack or I take a step to the left or to the right until I find that connection again or find a new avenue. So it's a bit of a, you know, for lack of a better word, it's a bit of a journey that way. And it's something I like to go through on my own.
Yeah.
Not to say that I don't, you know, value other people's input, or, and certainly my bandmates have a huge role to play. Once that song is written and once I feel like I've sort of poured the part of me that I need to into that song, then there are no people that I trust more than, you know, the four other guys in my band to help, you know,
bring it to life.
Chisel at it and bring it to life. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, you also got to trust your musicians that are playing on it, because it's, you know, a certain guitarist will take something and make it sound completely different than you envisioned it. I mean,
yeah, I think part of it was letting go of that at the beginning. So it's like, wait, I wrote it like this and it's supposed to be this, like this. And, you know,
My favorite story about that is I interviewed Brian Adams, and I was talking to him about working with Mutt Lange when they did Waking Up the Neighbors. And he said they wrote this song, they had this chorus, but he just really wasn't feeling the verse. And they had everything tracked, you know, drums, bass, like everything. So Mutt was like, oh, you don't like it? All right, well, hold on. He arm recorded everything in the verse, except the drums, left the drums and the bass, and recorded over it, and then punched out at the chorus. And Brian was like, what did you do? And Mutt was like, well, you didn't like the verse, so let's write a new verse. And Brian was like, we just worked on that for like 6 weeks and you just deleted everything. And his whole thing, Mutt, was like, don't be so precious with your ideas. Mm-hmm. You can always come up with something better.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a valuable lesson, but it's a really tough one to swallow the first few times. And I think, you got to get out of the way of your own music in a lot of ways, you know, and that whole idea of demoitis, it's very real.
Mm-hmm.
And it can stifle the potential that a song might have. And I think especially the producer that you choose to work with, like Mutt Lange, you have to allow them into it, into the sort of creative, not just sort of capturing all this and putting the appropriate bells and whistles on it, or to put a sort of a veneer over it and make it all shiny and beautiful. You have to allow them to sort of pull this idea apart. And I'm only starting, you know, I don't know, obviously the last 10 years or so, to be more comfortable and open with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was precious with the songs that I wrote. And I was very sort of protective, like a parent style protectiveness over it. But I realize now that, you stifle the possibilities, and you just kind of have to open yourself to that.
Well, look, I mean, we were born in a flame. 2 Juno Awards, you get Artist of the Year. I mean, you clearly were doing something right at the time, so you got to have a bit of confidence in that.
Well, yeah, but that confidence, you know,
journey to get there, I mean, that's how you build up that confidence.
You know, we've already gone all the way back. Like that journey, as they always say, the first record, you know, you have to sort of, you have a lifetime to write it, and then it's what comes after that. What lessons do you learn from that? It's hard to learn a lesson from your first record, actually. And that's why the second one is so difficult, because the first one literally starts when you're a kid, building up this moment to this moment. Your life transforms, your creative mind is in constant flux, and all of a sudden you sort of tap into these songs, and now you're sort of shot out of a cannon. It's when you have to consider your next step, that the sort of reality of what you're facing hits home. And I think we, like so many other bands, after the success of our first record, had to really, we just took a little while to figure out, well, what kind of band do we want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And what does songwriting, what is, you know, are we going to chase this? Are we going to chase that success at all costs? Or are we going to sort of go back to that idea that if it makes you feel good, then chances are it's going to make other people feel good too.
Yeah.
We just sort of adopted that as our not a motto necessarily, but, you know, as a sort of central philosophy. And sometimes that bears fruit, and sometimes you pay a price for that in terms of the trajectory of your career. And you have to be, if not at peace, at least you have to accept that.
Yeah. And at that point, I mean, the record, I mean, it blows up. You're getting all the notoriety. You're getting the Juno Awards. You got the radio play. You got Much Music. You know, everybody's on you. Is there a lot of pressure from the label for that follow-up? I mean, you got your A&R guy on your back saying, all right, well, we got a list of producers and co-writers we're going to pitch you in. Like, was there a lot of pressure for that follow-up record?
Yeah, there was, for sure. I mean, and we dealt with that pressure in a very specific way, which was to convince the record label that the only way that we could possibly create the right follow-up record was to go to Australia. Mm-hmm. So
you're like, I just won the Juno Award. You're sending me to Australia.
Well, I, in a brief moment of revelation, I was like, man, this is the only, if I don't play this card now,
yeah,
I'm never going to have this again. I'm never going to have this.
Give me the big advance. Give me all the money.
Yeah. I was like, I'm never going to have this leverage again. So I just said, look, it's been a crazy few years. I got to go as far away as possible from everything and everyone that I know in order to tap into the well again. Mm-hmm. And they bought it. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going for this. But they did it. You know, they did. And they signed off on it. And next thing you know, we packed everything up and we went to Australia for a few months thinking that we were just going to come back and deliver this, you know, mind-blowing second record to the label without them ever having had their hands on it and without even hearing a note. But
wow,
that's how naive we were, though. That they were, you know, that they were just going to sort of let us waltz off into the, you know, into the sunset and pitch up whenever we felt like it. So, of course, the shrewd A&R man announced after a couple of months that he was getting on the next flight to.
Oh no. It's like, uh-oh, the parents are on the way home. Oh, clean up, boys.
You have never seen people panic as hard as we did. We're like, oh my God, how is it? You know, because the record was, it felt like it had been, it felt like a car engine that was in parts all over the floor. Oh. And now you had to make sure that you could put the thing back together again and make it presentable or make a car move, you know?
That's and, an interesting way to describe it, actually.
That's what it looked like. And so we sort of, luckily Australia is pretty far from Canada, so it's quite a flight anyway. By the time he got, and we set the studio up, we were recording in this old church in the countryside. We set the studio up for maximum effect. We had like an oil slide projector. We're going to make this whole like hallucinogenic, like trippy experience. We had these couches set up. And the real thing was like, if we play it really loud, then all the bumps and bruises won't be detectable.
Of course, everything sounds better louder.
Absolutely.
Bump note, just
and in the dark with an oil lamp projecting all over the place. So anyway, long story short, it didn't work. Yeah. So he nodded politely and said, yeah, it looks like you guys, you're on the right path or whatever. But we thought we had a finished record. And I think he thought these are the most expensive demos ever made, you know?
Oh, man.
So yeah, it was a bit of a struggle. But in that process to find the silver lining of to it or whatever, we learned how to fight for what we thought was the record that we wanted to make. And yep. And we've kind of stuck to that ever since. And again, sometimes it's like, you know, the key to new opportunities, and sometimes it closes those doors, but it is who we are. And we kind of live and thrive or die by our own decisions. And that's the kind of band that I want to be.
Yeah. And look, I mean, that second record was an abysmal failure. I mean, they still went to number three on the album charts and, you know, a couple of, you know, I mean, it went platinum in the country. So, I mean, it wasn't entirely a wasted effort.
No, I think, again, for me, to this day, that's the record that I think I feel the most strongly connected to because of the fact that we went and sort of in the face of the pressure and the face of the expectations of trying to live up to this, the initial success.
Yeah.
We dug in our heels and in a way that has, it played more a part in defining how we go about being in a band. And again, probably why we are still a band to this day and still looking to the future all the time. You know, there's no more important record to us than the record that we're working on next.
Right.
And I think that experience of that second record forged that part of our identity.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, let's talk about The Adventures of Ben Blank that just came out this past fall. If people listening, you want to go and check it out, it's fantastic. I mean, talk a little bit about that and the journey to get to that. I mean, was this like a culmination of everything you've learned at this up to this point and you kind of put it into this album?
I mean, it is in a sense, but you're not necessarily conscious. In saying that, it has to be that. It has to be a culmination.
But you're not going in and saying like, all right, this is it's crunch time. Let's write a hit record. Like,
no. And you're also not saying, oh, let's just take this is what I liked about this record and this is what I liked about that and sort of, you know, creating some amalgam of all the things that worked for you in the past.
Yeah.
Every record is its own thing and you want it to stand. You want it to stand on its own two feet. And again, I go back to that simple rule of thumb is if I'm feeling something for what I'm writing, then I have to, and then I'll pursue it. And if I don't, then I'll find a new way. And in doing that, again, just the kind of human thread through all of that is that if I'm feeling this, I'm not so different from you or for anybody else out there. If I'm feeling what I'm feeling now, then I have to trust that somebody else out there is going to connect with what I'm doing. And I guess the difference in from record to record is that what I feel or how I think or how I move through the world, whether I conscious of it or not, has changed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you respect that idea, then the whole idea of evolution in music is literally just a sort of expression of the natural change that every individual goes through as they go through life.
Do your kids influence that? They're like, Dad, you gotta write like something that's gonna be big on TikTok. You need like a TikTok song.
Oh yeah, they're like the voice on the shoulder. But I, you know, the angel on my shoulder, the angel and the devil on the shoulder.
Right.
Like I get an earful of it all the time. You know, it's like, why don't you do that? The new Drake album, the new SZA album, the new, you know.
They're probably the best A&R team you can ask for, really.
Yeah. You know, and again, I'm like, man, it's like living with A&R people in your own home. It's not healthy.
It's the most toxic relationship ever.
It's just terrible. But at the same, you know, it's always a good reminder of you know, who's out there and who you know, you can't be preaching to the choir all the time too. And
right.
I think the idea of connecting with a new crop of people and young people is still really compelling to me. And it's definitely still something that I take to heart. And in the problem, or not the problem, but like the crux of the issue is like, are you going to sort of bend to accommodate what they think of as music, or are you going to show them what you think is important and try to bring them into a new sort of musical world that perhaps they haven't experimented with or heard before? And or maybe the answer is somewhere like a combination of the two. I suppose in some ways I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Well, look, I mean, a lot of people say it's like, I've interviewed people like Def Leppard, for example, and, you know, Joe Elliott told me, he's like, fans complained when we did, we did the Slang album. And he's like, oh, it doesn't sound like High and Dry or Pyromania. He's like, well, you can go listen to those. They're still there. They're still available to you. But if we kept making the same record over and over again, you'd still be talking shit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's the thing. It's like everybody wants you to tread the same path that you've been on before because it's familiar. But man, if you do that, then you get raked over the coals for that. So yeah. Again, you as the old cliche goes, you got to stick to your guns, whatever that means. And follow your own instincts and intuition.
Unless you're Angus Young and AC/DC, then you're allowed.
In which case you've found the perfect blueprint. And why change a thing?
Yeah. If it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Talk a little, we're running out of time, but real quick, talk a little bit about the live show and how important is it for you guys to be back on stage the first time in quite a couple of years now. What can fans expect on the upcoming tour dates? I know you just performed in Montreal a couple of weeks ago. I missed that one, but fans listening out on the West Coast and stuff, they'll be able to catch you.
Yeah, we're headed out again this weekend to Buffalo and Detroit, and then out pushing further west the following week. And it's been, we've been playing a lot over the last few years, but we haven't been playing tour shows. And a show on a tour is really different than playing a summer festival, for example, in that it's a real chance to dig into parts of this sort of your musical vault that you wouldn't otherwise. And that's become the sort of growing challenge over the years, is how do you marry the old with the, the middle ground with the brand new and make it all feel like it's a purposeful journey every night.
Well, the tour show, I mean, like, those are your fans on a festival stage. You're not necessarily all there to
absolutely
see you.
Yeah. And so I think the festival shows, you have this tendency to always be more lean towards the more conservative choices when it comes to which songs that you play. You want to play the hits. Play the hits, and then maybe try to sneak in a couple of, it's like trying to feed a kid their peas and carrots kind of thing, you know, in between bites of apple pie. It's like, that's what a festival can feel like a lot of the time. But a tour is different. A tour, you have an opportunity to make a real statement about where you're at, you know, in terms of your relationship with your own music. So yeah, coming up with a set list every night is a real dance to try to get to that place. And obviously leaning heavily on what the latest thing that you have to offer is too, because like I said, that's where our heart is right now. And that's what we want people to connect with, to realize that there's still this sort of living, breathing, heart at the, you know, that's still central to this band, and that what's around the next corner is still the most important thing.
No, totally. How much more expensive has it gotten for you to go out and tour?
Infinitely more. It's like all things, you know. I think people can relate to that in general. Just life has become more expensive, and there's no way that playing in a band is any different than that. From travel to accommodations to just everything. So, yeah, I mean, playing in a band isn't for the faint of heart at the best of times. And it's definitely... It puts you through, you know, puts you through the ringer for sure.
You do it for the love of it, you know.
And it has to be. That there's a vocational component to this that's just undeniable, you know. Mm-hmm. You have to, for lack of a better word, you have to believe that this is what you should be doing, because anything short of that, it stops making sense really quickly. So,
yeah, you have to do it for the love of it. And yeah, it is the music business, not the music hobby. Mm-hmm. You got to be able to pay bills. But if you can pay bills and have fun at the same time, what more do you want?
Yeah. And every year is a big question mark, and you just try to thread the needle. Like, and we've been able to do it. So, you know, we'll keep doing it until somebody pulls out the plug on us.
Yeah. The hang up question, where's the best steamy in Montreal?
Oh, my God. Lester's Deli.
Lester's Deli. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I haven't been there in ages.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, otherwise you go to La Belle Pro, you know?
Well, La Belle Pro, or what do you think? Montreal Pool Room or La Belle Pro? Which one's better?
I mean, that's Montreal Pool Room is more of a boutique, you know? I think La Belle Pro is like an everyman's steamy.
Yeah.
So.
Or the AA down the road from the Corona Theater. Haven't been there in a while.
I haven't had one there, to be honest. Old I'm man, no stranger to man. A Lafleur's from time to time either, so
dude,
you know, there's a reason. Lafleur's. There's a reason why the name has persisted through the ages.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, that's a great, great question.
I still love the toasted dogs at the Bell Center. I say that they're the best in the NHL. You can't beat them.
Listen, you know, chock full of protein and vibes.
That's it. You know, and that's the name of your next record.
Yeah, protein and vibes. That's right.
I'm gonna, you know what? I'm going to start a gym brand. That's going to be the gym and protein and vibes.
That's great, man. We're officially a partnership now.
I love it. Sam Roberts' latest record, Adventures of Ben Blank. Go check it out and go pick up tickets. Go check them out on tour. Go see them on the road. Fantastic live show and great Montreal band who are now essentially Canadian icons. I'm saying Walk of Fame at some point.
We'll cross that bridge when you come to it. Not ready for that. Thank you very much.
Is that where you get to the point in their career? You're like, oh, wait, I'm old now?
I think so, yeah, officially. So, no, I'm not there. Okay, fighting it off.
We'll give it another 10, 15 years.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
All right, Sam. Appreciate you taking the time to chat. It was great to officially meet you.
Yeah, same here, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on, man.
The Jeremy White Show.
Get exclusive interviews and bonus content on demand now. Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show.